This is Rick Hogan. I was thinking, well, I'm going to play these cuts from a You'll Be Swingin' Christmas album, and they'll all sound like Christmas. That doesn't even sound like Christmas yet. The rest are, I'm filling in for Bill and Wendy. Today, on air from 10 or 10:11 till noon, and then on the stream, from noon to 1 on the stream, I'm replaying an old, not that old, couple weeks old, fascinating interview I did on my Sunday night show with the legendary Joe Siegel, who for 70 years in this town has been keeping jazz alive. But it is my distinct pleasure to have the cookies in here from the Polo Inn. Dave Samber has been a pioneer, a restaurateur, B&B pioneer in the neighborhood of Bridgeport for more than 30 years. Is it 33 years? David, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Rick. Oh, bring us some Polo cookies. Oh, bring us some Polo cookies. Oh, bring us some Polo cookies and bring them right here.
Well, you did already. Yeah, you did already.
Well, that's
we'll all have them. David is on to specifically talk about a few things going on at the Polo Inn during the holidays. But before that, because David is a fascinating character. What? What do you mean, uh-oh?
You write obituaries, don't...
I do that occasionally. I've also written about the Polo Cafe.
Yes.
Pioneering in that neighborhood, take me back, David, to when and why you decided to move to Morgan Street, which certainly, I mean, even now, it's not like moving to, you know, Russian Division or something, no. State and Division.
That's where I left, though. I used to live in Newbury Plaza.
I know.
I don't know, Rick. You know, you have to somehow look back and say that's what God wanted. And so... we bought the building on Morgan Street as an investment to try to fix up the apartments and rent them out, almost sight unseen. And when we saw it, finally, we realized how dilapidated the property really was.
What had it been, though?
This is
what really influenced your career.
Yeah, exactly. 1914, this building was built. So over 100 years ago, and it was built by a Lithuanian who was married to a Polish woman. And on that side of Morgan Street was Polish.
Mm-hmm.
The other side of the street was Lithuanian. So for her to be able to, for him to be able to build on that side, he had to have a Polish wife, right? And there was a trolley track that ran down Morgan Street, I understand, and ran into the stockyards.
Yeah.
So there really was the other side of the tracks in Bridgeport. And depending on where you were, that had a lot to do with what kind of job you had and where you went to church and who you hung out with. And
but it was a confectionery, too.
Well, so originally it started as Kupcha's Confectionery and ice cream and sundries. I have a bag full of the original documents of the building. For example, the Alex's ledgers for when he would pay his accounts. Maybe this carpenter got $1.11 and this guy got something else. And it all totaled up to $13,700, which was a lot of money in 1914.
No kidding.
And they continued through the Depression. They started apparently sometime to charge licenses to raise more money in the city. So I have a whole series of 1930, 31, 32, 33, 34, 35, of licenses to allow them to sell tobacco and some of those probably products that they were getting more taxes on.
That did, though, inspire you to say to yourself, because you were not just a real estate guy, you were a chef.
Yeah, well, I had hung out with Monique Hooker.
Right.
So when she opened up Monique's Cafe in 1983, I was all in. I was there 3 days a week, and I worked for free, and sous chef, and marketing, and you name it. We did so much together. By the time 1984 came around, the real estate market had really gotten pretty depressing.
Sure.
Interest had gone, prime had gone to 21, and I was involved with a real estate development that had a $4 million loan to First National Bank of Chicago at 2.5 over prime. So we were paying 23.5% interest. So at some point, this was no longer a fun game, real estate development. And so as I thought about how could I change my life? What would I do? And I thought, well, I don't want to open a restaurant. That was too much work. My gosh, I can't work that hard. I just did that with Monique. But a candy store, maybe I was impressed always with Nuts on Clark and what Estelle and Robert did over the years. So how hard could it be to buy something in a big box and sell it in a little bag? at a quarter pound or pound at a time.
Dave Samber, everything is hard. We got to take a break. We now have Dave Samber back in 33 years ago, 34 years ago.
I was so young. Jeez.
I know. Well, you look young, too. He's going to be here until a quarter two talking about the many events going on at the now called Polo Inn. It used to be called Polo Cafe, but the website is now thepoloinn.com. We'll be right back. Another thing that I think is really healthy for your gut and stomach is the food and cookies at the Polo Inn. Dave Samber, who has run that place for more than three decades in Bridgeport, came there as a real pioneer in that area. And quickly, Dave, in 33 years ago, it was a commercial wasteland, wouldn't you say?
It had been abandoned.
Yeah.
It was that strip at one time.
Morgan Street.
On Morgan Street. That strip, again, Polish one side. And then there was a white flight in the 50s,
sure,
and the 60s. By the 70s, a lot of places were gone. And then there was no reason to fix things up. There still is a tough reason, just because the density of the population of the area is so low. It's not a good economic base.
How were you welcomed by...
Ooh.
By? No, I'm serious about that.
It
because
was
I think,
tough. Initially,
I'll bet.
It was.
I mean, you must have been seen as an outsider, and there's always, especially at that time, there's a fearfulness of strangers.
Well, it was tougher then than it is now, let me say. It was much more welcoming.
Sure.
But I can remember, I had one time, I had my license plate said Polo Nut, P-O-L-O-N-U-T.
That's smart.
And I was driving, well, come on, gotta promote. So yeah. I was driving by the Sox Park at that time, and the policeman pulled me over. And I thought, gee, officer, I didn't do anything wrong. What was it? He said, you own Polo Nut, that place on Morgan? I said, yes. He said, what do you know that we don't know?
Interesting.
And I thought, and I said to myself, you know what?
Interesting.
There's oil, and I pump it at midnight when no one can hear. And I laughed,
and
I thought,
and the cop put the handcuffs
right
on you. Yeah.
But the idea was, people could, yeah, they were suspicious. What was this North Sider doing there? You know what? Again, I really wanted to establish a base that I could have a home for the rest of my days.
Yeah.
I didn't want to go from one apartment to one condo to this to that. I really wanted to something that was almost recession proof, but that I could sort of hang out here and make this my base and have a life.
It's been an incredible life. Absolutely did that. You purchased the building next door, which was for a time a Lithuanian movie theater. Then it became an auto mechanic store, and it's now the Golden Eagle.
It's the old Eagle Room.
Where you throw weddings, including one of mine, weddings and all sorts of other events and parties. You opened up some of the upstairs above the restaurant to, I remember seeing it a few years ago, into a B&B. Right. You have a...
And parking, free parking.
That's right, the incredible free parking.
What more could you want?
I can't imagine what more you could
want. And
that's
just it. It was a chance to really take the dreams and dream the dreams and live the dreams.
Yeah.
And rather than just keep dreaming and dreaming and dreaming. Some people just go through life, I think, and they just don't get anything accomplished. But they have a lot of good ideas.
Yeah.
I have some pretty good ideas, and once in a while we're able to make it happen.
How many rooms do you have now?
There's four suites upstairs.
And they are all themed.
Each to the Bridgeport neighborhood. So because there were five mayors from Bridgeport.
Sure. Do you still have that? I haven't been down there, sadly, in a couple of years. Do you still have that fabulous mural in the front
with
pictures of the mayors?
Yes, absolutely. Jacqueline Harrison is the artist. I just spoke to her a few weeks ago. She's going to touch it up. Needs a little touch up. It was done that was just it. Bridgeport, as it turned out, celebrated its sesquicentennial in 1986. So I opened in 85. Well, during that time, there was some community interest in trying to mark this occasion.
Sure.
And I, of course, being the North Side, being involved in every committee and every board, and I thought, oh, absolutely, I could contribute to this. Well, I don't think it was – we got to know each other, but I think it was a time when it was not nearly as – open as it would be now.
The neighborhood has changed so dramatically, and Bridgeport remains one of the most fascinating Chicago neighborhoods to me.
It's all about people.
It's history. But they've also, done a remarkable kind of multi-million dollar remaking of Morgan Street.
Well, thank you very much for noticing.
Well, you said, you told me a couple
absolutely.
Days ago that it is something
out of
Dickens.
So the first shall be last, and last shall be first. Well, we were the we're the ugly stepsister all these years, and now we're the Cinderella, because from 31st south to 35th, and I'm in 33rd, so I'm right in the middle of all that, through a TIF finance project, we were able to do a streetscape, $4.1 million streetscape.
Wow.
That gave us the infrastructure, so we have new water mains, new sewers, and then resurfaced the top and striped it. We have stripes. We have actually side crosswalks that you can identify. But we have new bump outs and curbs and sidewalks from one end of the street to the next that are all brand new. And then the beautiful antique light posts with LED lighting. So at night, it absolutely is glorious.
You said it's something out of a Charles Dickens story.
Wow, because it's only for two blocks, three blocks, four blocks long, so it's not the whole neighborhood. But when you get on, all of a sudden, there's something about it that says, "Gee, all these buildings are sort of charming and quaint."
No question.
And it's not
a wasteland.
Yeah, there's actually things happening now.
It's visually exciting and stimulating. Right. Have you seen this increased business there? Has there been a...
Yeah, sure.
That's what a TIF fund is supposed to do.
And, of course, that's all relative to where we were and where we've been.
Sure.
I don't think we're going to see the 2004, 5, 6 years in my lifetime anymore. Those were just huge years.
Yeah.
But we're not seeing the real... I mean, for example, there was a time when there would be no Christmas parties booked. There would be no, not even teachers. There's nothing. This year we have some, and our cookie trays are flying out the door as usual.
Do you really make, Dave Samber, 38,000 cookies?
Yeah.
Well, you say it's a matter of fact. Like, I make 38,000.
But I have a staff that makes all this happen.
Well, you brought in about 10 or 12 for us to share here. But
in these trays, though, this is the other tray.
Yeah.
This side, the 12-inch tray, the 14-inch tray, the 20-inch trays, these great big massive 12 dozen cookies with 4 dozen of the Linder balls. But see, remember Stop and Shop?
Yeah, well,
sure you do, of course.
Sure.
On Randolph?
Yeah.
Well, they would have these magnificent, one-of-a-kind almost, these you wouldn't find them anywhere else. Well, that's what we wanted to be. And in order to be why someone would come to me and not go to Marshall Fields or go to Target or somewhere, we had to be something different, something wonderful. And we started it, and now all these years later, we're still doing it.
That's the slogan, and that's the truth, ladies and gentlemen. Go to thepoloinn.com while we're getting some commercials and you're hearing the news, and we'll be back after that with Dave Samber to talk about he loves the holidays. He loves the holidays, and there's nothing like Christmas for him and, in turn, for you. We'll be right back.
Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Let your heart be light.
That song is from a great CD called You'll Be Swingin'. I'm Rick Hogan, filling in for Bill and Wendy. I have some more time left with Dave Samber, who runs the Polo Inn in Bridgeport. It is thepoloinn.com. It is a wonderful kind of theater event space. It is also a fantastic restaurant. It is also a B&B. It's like you're the Bill Gates of Bridgeport. You've turned into the Bill Gates of Bridgeport, an entrepreneur. David, you got a lot of things going on, and the reason I wanted you to come in, we could talk forever about Bridgeport and its history and your history in Bridgeport. Bridgeport is one of those neighborhoods that is not just on the rebound. It's going to be a showplace one of these days, and you are at the center of it all. There's a brunch on December 17th. It's called the Twas the Brunch, 7 days before the night before Christmas. That's one of your big things. What goes on there?
It's our annual, it's become sort of a tradition for folks to get together and gather during the holidays. And so this gives particularly families and friends to do it, because we take reservations, and like we normally do for Mother's Day and Easter, we give table assignments based on the size of your group or the size of your
nice.
Reservation.
Nice.
So you have to make a reservation, But it's a wonderful buffet. It's got lots of our favorite things, including our barbecue ribs and creme brulee, and it goes on and on and on. But all those menus are on our website, and that's from 10:30 till 2 o'clock on Sunday, concurrent with our gospel brunch, which is on the other side of the building, so it's on the cafe side. And that's every Sunday. That's a sing-along gospel brunch from 10 until 2 on Sundays. We're in our fifth year. Rick, that's become the biggest shift of the week.
Oh, no question.
3 weeks ago, we had 100 people on one Sunday.
Wow.
100 people
wow.
went through there.
You also are having on the your 15th annual Eve, you're having two of my favorite people down there, Mark and Ann Burnell.
Mark called me recently and asked if they could take my stage for that. This is their 15th annual.
I know.
And they used to have it at Pegasus Restaurant, which is no longer available. So consequently, they're bringing it to me. But Ann and Mark were on my stage around 2003 and 2004 when I was trying to get a jazz club going there.
Yeah, sure.
And they came on Wednesdays, and they would play with Buddy Charles. So those were wonderful times, and they know the space, they know the sound, they know the acoustic.
They are, I must tell you something, knowing them really well, you just made my heart leap thinking of Buddy.
Buddy, right.
But they are perfect for that room.
Yeah, exactly.
They are the perfect sort of entertainers.
So they're coming, and we're offering a $35 per person, which includes the buffet and the show, at 7:30. So everything starts at 7:30. On the night before New Year's Eve, December the 30th. And then New Year's Eve, we're going to have our prefix feast from 6 to 8. It's not a party with all the noisemakers. It's a wonderful evening,
wonderful
music, a great meal. And then you're home to watch the 10 o'clock news. So that's how we do it at
Polo. You seem to have, Dave Samber, against all reason, you seem to have the energy of a 25-year-old. Why is that? What is it about you, do you think? I mean, I know you love what you do.
I do, Rick. And you know, that's the difference, maybe.
Yeah.
I go back to my years with Gordon Sinclair.
Sure.
And I knew what we took a class together with him. We talked about customers, cash, and commitment.
Yeah.
And as customers and cash, you could figure them out one way or the other, but the commitment is something that's only you can decide what you want to do. And I made the commitment, this was going to be my life, and if you're going to do it, my mother used to say, you only have one time, you know, do it right.
One time around, man.
Do it right. And so consequently, it is a life setting in Bridgeport. I become sort of part of the neighborhood without thinking.
Oh my God,
now.
No
and
question.
I sing at funerals and at weddings and from neighbors and then we have all the different events that we can accommodate up to 100 guests. We can accommodate lots of different events, showers and graduations and anniversaries.
It is. I mean, I can vouch for this. I mean, I have been there a number of times, and it is a great place. It is also a uniquely Chicago place, to my mind. Another thing that must keep you very active is having a 5-year-old son named Bentley is now 5 years
Bentley,
old.
Yeah.
He's been with you about half his life.
Yeah, two.
And that must keep you. What a great place. Also, what a great place for a kid to grow up.
That's
an incredible place for a kid to grow up.
His teacher, he goes to St. Jerome School in Bridgeport, and his teacher said, she's never seen a little kid with more energy and a bigger vocabulary.
Wow.
And I think that's really because being around all the adults that he is.
Sure.
For a while, he used to come and sort of sneak the fruit off your plate or something if you weren't looking. Now he'll come and play the violin for you.
Does he sing without
being... Yes, he does. He sings.
He's just like dad, like son.
Well,
he sings.
It's interesting because he shakes his head sometimes. Where he's learning the national anthem. But now, what 5-year-old wants to learn the national anthem? Well, he's heard me singing enough at different places, and there's a picture in the room that was of me when I sang at Wrigley Field. So somehow he emulates that, and he watches, and he actually shakes his head as he sings a little bit.
God.
So he's very precocious, and he's the most precious thing that's come my way, and it's great to have him.
If you were intrigued by Dave Samber and the Polo Inn, it would behoove you now or sometime today to go to the PoloInn.com, have a look at the menu, have a look at the rooms, have a look at the Old Eagle Theater, and get down there. That's what I would recommend, David.
Well, it took me 12 minutes to get here from there this
morning.
Yeah,
exactly. No, that's the other thing about it.
The drive was great.
It's uniquely Chicago, just as the neighborhood is. It is uniquely Chicago, and it is not producing mayors with the frequency that it once did, but it...
Well, we got a super alderman, though, Pat...
that's right.
Thompson.
Yeah, who is related to who?
Yes,
yeah,
well,
to who?
Well,
David, it's great to see
thanks,
you.
Thanks, Rick. Thanks
stick
so
around.
Much. Let me just shout out to my staff.
Sure.
So much.
They've
my
been
customer,
there forever, right?
Yeah, Sally's still helping make the bows to the cookie trays. She's in her 31st year, and Ronnie, who I know his whole family's listening, and Esmeralda and Maria and Martin and Kevin and Kurtan and Jack and Claudia and Angie, who's probably listening from home right now. So
they have all,
thank you. They've all been with me for years and years.
Well,
and
they
years
have
and
all
years.
Over the years poured me very, very stiff drinks down
we
there.
We have 179
too.
Years of service
good
with
Lord.
My current.
Well, that says,
that's amazing.
That loyalty says something very important. David, stick
thanks.
Around. I'm going to read a Mike
oh,
Morico.
Thanks, Rick.
We'll be right back.
It's
Rick Hogan filling in for Bill and Wendy, and as I do every holiday season, though I'm not going to be on Christmas Eve or New Year's Eve on my Sunday night show, I read a couple Mike Royko columns. Here is one of them. You think of Royko as the great hard ass of Chicago journalism. Hey, here you go, ladies and gentlemen. The conversation at the bar got around the Christmas trees. Somebody had mentioned how much they cost today and what a pain in the neck it is to go out in the bitter cold and shop around for a good one. Nah, said Slats Grobnik. There's nothing to it. Not if you know what you're doing. What makes you an expert? I used to work in a tree lot when I was a young guy. My uncle used to sell them in the vacant lot next to his tavern, and that's when I learned the secret. What secret? The secret of having the most beautiful tree you ever saw. Well, that's easy. The secret is to go out with a pocket full of money and spend what it takes to buy the best tree. Slat shook his head. Uh-uh. Money's not the secret. So, Slats, tell us the secret. All right. It was a long time ago, maybe 30 years. I was in the lot, and it was a night before Christmas Eve, about a half hour before I was going to close up. I hadn't seen a customer in 2 hours. I had maybe a couple dozen trees left, and most of them weren't much to look at. By the time you get that close to Christmas, they've been picked over pretty good. So I'm standing by the kerosene heater when this young couple comes in and starts looking at the trees. I don't know them by name, but I know they live down the street in the basement of one of the dumpiest three flats in the neighborhood. He's a skinny guy with a big Adam's apple and a small chin, not much to look at. She's kind of pretty, though, but they're both wearing clothes that look like they came out of the bottom bin at the Salvation Army store. It's cold as a witch's toes, but neither of them have got on gloves or heavy shoes, so it's easy to see that they're having a hard time with the paychecks. Well, they start lifting the trees up and looking at them and walking around them the way people do. They finally find one that's pretty decent. Not a great tree, but it wasn't bad, and they ask me how much. It was about $8 or $9. They don't say anything. They just put it down. But they keep looking. They must have looked at every tree in the lot. Like I said, there weren't many that were any good. But every time I gave them a price on a decent one, they just shook their heads. Finally, they thank me and walk away. But when they get out on the sidewalk, she says something, and they stand there talking for a while. Then he shrugs, and they come back. I figure they're going to take one of those good trees after all. But they go over to this one tree that had to be the most pathetic tree we had. It was a Scotch pine that was okay on one side, but the other side was missing about half the branches. They asked me how much that one was. I told them that they'd have a hard time making it look good, no matter how much tinsel they put on it, but they could have it for a couple of bucks. Then they picked up another one that was damn near as pathetic. Same thing, full on one side but scraggly on the other. They asked how much for that one. I told them that was a deuce, too. So then she whispers something to him, and he asked me if I'll take $3 for the two of them. Well, what am I going to do? Nobody's going to buy those trees anyway, so I told them they had a deal. But I tell them, what do you want with those two trees? Spend a few dollars more and get yourself a nice tree. She just smiled and said they wanted to try something. So they gave me the $3, and he carried them off. She carried one. He took the other. The next night, I happened to be walking past their building. I looked down at the window, and I can see a tree. I couldn't see it all, but what was there looked good. The lights were on, so I figure, what the heck? I knock on the door. They opened it, and I tell them I noticed the tree, and I was just curious. They let me in, and I almost fell over. There in this tiny parlor was the most beautiful tree I ever saw. It was so thick, it was almost like a bush. You couldn't see the trunk. Then they told me how they did it. They took the two trees and worked the trunks close together so they touched where the branches were thin. Then they tied the trunks together with wire. But when the branches overlapped and came together, it formed a tree so thick you couldn't see the wire. It was like a tiny forest of its own. The two of them looked so happy with it, it made me feel good for the rest of the week. And thinking of those two orphan trees, which would have been tossed out if they hadn't come along, that made me feel good, too. So, there you go. That's the secret. You take two trees that aren't perfect, that have flaws, that might even be homely, that maybe nobody else would ever want. But you put them together just right, you can come up with something really beautiful. Like two people, I guess. You don't have to applaud Royko, are you kidding?
Magnolia trees at night, sparkling bright. Fields of cotton love, wintry white. When it's Christmas time and new. A barefoot choir and prayer fills the air. Mississippi folks gathering there, 'cause it's Christmas time in New Orleans. You see a Dixieland Santa Claus leading the band to a good old Creole beak. Golly, what a spirit. You can only hear it down on Basin Street. Your cares will disappear when you hear, hallelujah, St. Nicholas is here. When it's Christmas time in New Orleans. Disappear, and when you hear hallelujah, old Santa is near. When it's Christmas time in New Orleans, yes, when it's Christmas time, it's Christmas time in New Orleans.
Welcome back. This is Rick Cogan filling in for Bill and Wendy until noon down here, and then from noon to one on the stream, where I will replay for your listening pleasure a pretty rare interview with Joe Siegel, who runs the Jazz Showcase and who has kept jazz alive here almost single-handedly for the last 70 years. He moved to Chicago a couple of years ago, and Jeremy McCarter has been to a Cubs game. He has yet to go to the Billy Goat, as far as I know, because he promised he would go with me.
I've been saving myself.
Huh? Yeah, you better save yourself. You're not going to do it over the holidays. That's too crazy. But he has also, he not only finished a book here.
Two books here. I finished both.
You finished both here?
Oh, Rick,
you
did? I've been busy.
Well, there's one book that's relatively famous, a book about Hamilton. Jeremy, if you would, and not to belabor it, because you probably told the story 1,000 times, you were a theater critic in New York. You wrote a review of one of Lin-Manuel's early shows.
Yep.
He thought you had a sort of good sense of theater. He said, let's go out and have drinks. You went out and had drinks, and what happened when you had drinks?
Well, we've reconstructed what happened when we had drinks, because we both had a lot of drinks. But as near as we can tell from the emails that we exchanged over the next couple of days, this is the summer of 2008. And he tells me, I ask him what he's doing next. And he says, well, I'm reading this biography by Ron Chernow. It's about Alexander Hamilton. And I think I want to write a hip hop mixtape about Alexander Hamilton's life.
Mm-hmm.
And then reconstructing the way I still think about that idea, I laughed my head off. Because that's insane. And I loved the guy, and I thought he was a huge talent. I wished him well. I thought it was going to be crazy. And, of course, we know a year later, he's at the White House performing the opening number. A couple years after that, I have now gone to work at the Public Theater, and part of my job is to bring in artists to meet my boss and see if we can work together. And the first artist I want to bring in is Lin to talk about this crazy idea. And now we know the crazy ideas. The biggest hit, and one of the biggest hits in the entire history of the art form.
Well, it's also one of the things about Hamilton is it is not only a wildly entertaining and very, very successful musical. It has had a profound ripple effect, has it not? That must be so. It sometimes must just make you shake your head, but it also must be so gratifying. No one can anticipate that.
Right. Yeah. To have been inside this phenomenon and watch it happen is like living in a science fiction movie,
yeah.
A 6-year-long science fiction movie. I mean, just last night, it had its first performance in London. Now, imagine a show about these scrappy colonists overthrowing the British monarch is now playing in London. And apparently they're eating it up. So,
I'll bet.
Good for the Brits. But yeah, but to me, it's the fact that it's a huge hit and people love it today is really exciting. To me, the most exciting thing about it, though, is the way we know in a couple years the show is going to be licensed. And that means schools are going to get to do it, colleges, high schools, amateur groups. Now, imagine when you've got hundreds and hundreds of young Americans getting to step into the shoes of George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, and Alexander Hamilton, and have the experience that the original actors had. And what they told me it meant to them about how they saw themselves, how they saw their relationship to this country, that's going to be a generational rite of passage. Now, I can't tell you what that's going to do, but I know it's going to do something, and I can't wait to find out.
You and your pal put together a book about the making of Hamilton and about the play itself. That when I wrote about it, I guess it was probably last year, and read it and also saw it, it is, to my mind, the most remarkable book about a theatrical experience. You didn't want, I'm sure there are a million people out there, if Lin-Manuel called and said, hey, you want to collaborate with me on a book about Hamilton, they'd go, yeah, absolutely, whatever you want,
right.
Whatever you want. But the two of you, and again, this goes to the sort of heart of what Hamilton is all about, and the creative spirit of both you guys. You said, no, we don't want to do a conventional book. Like, I don't want to describe it. You can look up my piece about it that I wrote in the Tribune, or listen to Jeremy talk about it now. You did not want the same, oh, we'll have 500 pictures of the cast, because all casts are relatively attractive when you're on Broadway. You wanted to do something else.
That's right. It is true that you Broadway actors tend to be attractive people. This cast is the most photogenic group of humans ever assembled.
And also Ron Chernow is the most luckiest historian. Not that he's not good, but he's also the luckiest historian who's ever written a biography.
Ron's a friend. He's got a great new book out about Ulysses S.
Yes,
Grant.
He does.
Ron is the happiest historian in America. But Lin asked me if I would write the book with him. He was going to write annotations to his lyrics.
Yeah.
And I was going to write the story. And I didn't want to do it at first because I thought, I've been asked to write these books before. And
sure.
They're great. You know, it's useful to have a book that sort of rides next to a show. But I didn't see how you could do one of those about Hamilton because the conventional model didn't feel right. Not for this show's ambition, not for the way it was breaking all these rules. And I went away and thought about it and just thought, actually, you know, it's telling the story of a revolution.
Yep.
It is itself a revolution. So if there's a way to structure a book so that you feel like you're reading one story that is about one shared revolution that can kind of shift back and forth between what's happening on stage and what's happening around the stage, yeah. Lin and the director and that an unbelievable company.
And the cast, yeah.
Putting it all together, that'd be a cool book. So that's what we did. We had 6 months and we knocked it out.
Yeah, you did it fast. You know, like a newspaper man or something.
We wrote like we were running out of time,
yeah,
you might say.
Yeah, it is a remarkable book, and I'm sure it's going to be on the Christmas gift list of half of Chicago.
It's big for a stocking, but I bet folks will figure it out.
It is really big for a stocking, but it would fit under a tree. I think it would fit under a tree. Jeremy will be here until about 1:45 talking about only a little bit more about Hamilton. I do want to talk about the Young Radicals, too, after a break, and then about his new venture. It is called Make Believe, and it is going to make a splash this coming Monday at the Harold Washington Library. We'll be back in a couple minutes. Like Jeremy McCarter is in here, is the author of Hamilton, A Revolution, which is certainly going to be a big Christmas gift, but if you're a discerning person and a want to give something provocative in addition to something really handsome and fun, the people, the Young Radicals is a fabulous book that you wrote here too, Jeremy, and that was long brewing. This whole Hamilton stuff got in the way of that book, didn't it?
Well, yeah, I just saw Lin a couple weeks ago and I reminded him of how insane it was that I had sent in the first full draft of my book, Young Radicals, which is a book about these idealistic young Americans in the World War I years. I had sent that to my publisher, Random House, 10 minutes before I got in the cab to go to the Public Theater for the first opening night of Hamilton. And it was that night at the party when Lin said to me, so there's going to be this book and you should write this book. And I said to him, do you know how crazy that was? That I had just handed in a book. He's like, yeah, I know. That's why I asked you that.
Can't we make it a package and sell the two books right. together? Yeah.
But Young Radicals had been percolating for a while, but I got fascinated in this moment in American history that we kind of have lost sight of for some reason. There was this moment in the early 20th century when there was a generation that came of age, and this might sound familiar, came of age with these high hopes, these expectations about progress, and they felt like the solutions were out there and they were about to be seized. And then like that, all of that hope and all that optimism got smashed to pieces. When the United States went into World War I, the entire climate of the country changed. And I wanted to tell the story of these five young people who had been chasing these ideals about economic opportunity and justice and fairness and dignity and how they were put to the chase by a country going war mad.
You can, by looking up WGN Radio, Kogan and McCarter, hear a lengthy interview we had about the book. One of the things that was so intriguing about the book was the fact that a couple of the people I knew of, and then you introduced me to three other fascinating characters. Talk just for a bit about these five people.
Yeah, so I knew that the era was too complicated to write about one person, but I also just felt like what was important about these people is that they were willing to live and die for some vision of a better world. And if you're willing to suffer real physical pain for this abstraction that's out there in front of you, then it needs to be about a couple of people, real stories, real struggles. So I picked five. There's Walter Lippmann. A lot of people might remember him. Famous newspaper columnist. In those days, he was kind of a lefty, you know, sort of political operative, I guess you'd call him. There was Max Eastman, who was a poet and an editor, who then ended up with the National Review, which is surprising. There's John Reed, if anyone remembers Warren Beatty's movie Reds. That's about John Reed. There is Randolph Bourne, who was a cultural critic. He was a prophet. He was an unbelievable spirit. And I wanted to try to remind people that, you know, we produce, this country can produce people like that who have that kind of vision. And then lastly is the person who has, I'm glad to see, has resonated the most since the book came out, which is the suffragist Alice Paul.
Yeah.
She's an incredible story. She was this tiny, soft-spoken, scholarly Quaker. And she decides that women ought to vote. And it's unjust that women can't vote. And to get women the vote, she will do absolutely anything. She will lead a movement. She will stage parades. She will be arrested and beaten and force-fed and you name it. And she prevails.
Bourne is an interesting character, too, because he's sort of this physically misshapen person. Yeah. And all five of these characters are rather amazing. And the way in which Jeremy McCarter weaves their stories into this powerful narrative of the young radicals is really something. Again, you can just Google WGN Cogan McCarter, and you can listen to an hour-long interview where we get much deeper into that book. So you finish that book. It gets good reviews. You do some book promotion things. And then all of a sudden, and it cannot be all of a sudden, you decide that you want to start a nonprofit production company here. I have to believe that that notion was percolating. Well, maybe not. Maybe it is. It is seeded and nurtured by what you found when you came and got to know Chicago, yes?
Yeah. Look, it's about the experiences I've had over the last few years. You know, I was working at the Public Theater. I got to see, you know, Joe Papp was my hero, the creator of Shakespeare in the Park, the founder of the Public. I had that inspiration. I had the inspiration of Hamilton, of getting to see a story change the world in ways that you can watch happening. And I had the story of Young Radicals, which is about seeing what it looks like when people are really willing to fight for something that they believe in. And I'm thinking about all this stuff here in Chicago. Chicago, a city that loves to make things, that wants to, that asks you, it feels to me, having just gotten here a couple of years ago, okay, but what are you going to contribute? What are you going to build now here? And this city's theater culture is unbelievable. In a lot of ways, it's more vibrant than New York's.
How so?
In New York, New York's theater scene is very vertical. Everybody knows, well, people think that Broadway's at the top. That's where you want to get. That's where you get the most attention. You get paid the most. It's what, you know, has the biggest audiences. And then you've got at the bottom, off Broadway, where it's always scrappy. It's always scrambling. Once in a very long while, you get something great. Chicago is not vertical that way. Chicago's horizontal. There are a couple of big, prominent theaters at the top. There are a couple of, you know, there are a lot of little scrappy companies, but there's this broad middle that just doesn't exist in New York, where if you go to theater, you know, it's the storefront scene, it's the medium-sized companies, equity actors, non-equity actors, everybody working together here, where it just feels like there's room for everybody. And to me, as a producer, that's unbelievably inspiring.
Yeah. How much theater have you been able to see here?
Well, it's funny. You know, I moved here a couple years ago, and I say that I've lived in Chicago for a couple years, yeah, except because I was on book deadline. Basically, all I saw of it for those couple years was my laptop and Terminal 2 at O'Hare when I had to fly back to New York, which I had to do, you know, sometimes three times in a month. And now I'm getting to see more, and the quality of the work is great.
Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, you come here with deep, deep knowledge and affection for all things theater, but you're seeing the Chicago scene with brand new eyes. Yeah. There are a lot of people who are in part of this Chicago theater scene here who are kind of jaded about it, and their ambition is to start yet another storefront theater, and that is not at all what you're doing. So how does this coalesce into, what is the moment, Jeremy McCarter? Oh, we got to take a break in a minute, but we're going to devote the whole rest of the show to the Make-Believe Association. What is the moment that gives birth to the Make-Believe Association? Is it a conversation with somebody? Is it waking up in the middle of the night? Is it your kid saying, Dad, I'm sick of you writing books?
It's a little bit feeling like if I try to write another book through a Chicago winter, it's gonna be The Shining around here. But it's a lot feeling like, if I'm out of writing mode, I'm going back to producing mode. What's the way that I can try to realize these ideals, this hope that I have for stories?
Yeah.
And it just feels like, well, the way to do that is take everything I've learned, take what Chicago's offering, and let's start building.
We will explore how that has manifested itself with its first event Monday, free. I know that appeals to everybody. Free at the Harold Washington Library at 7 o'clock. We will get deeper into that after some commercials and the news, and I come back with Jeremy McCarter. Hi, this is Rick Cogan filling in for Bill and Wendy and continuing my conversation with Jeremy McCarter, the author of two amazing books, Hamilton, The Revolution and The Young Radicals. But I think more importantly, and though books can live forever, what may wind up being, if it continues on, it just started, it would be a great, great legacy. It's called the Make Believe Association. It's a nonprofit production company that has its first show Monday at the Harold Washington Library. What is the Make Believe Association, Jeremy?
It's a new Chicago production company. It's nonprofit. The idea is to tell great stories, have great actors read great plays, new plays, old plays, you name it. Do it for an audience that is drawn from across Chicago. Do it for free, always. And after we do these stories, share these great old plays or these new plays, then give the audience a chance to talk about it.
There's a cliche about audience talkbacks that I think you are going to effectively break. Usually it's like, yes, where did you get the idea for this play? And right. Or I once saw a play like this. Right. You know exactly what I mean. You must have seen hundreds of these kind of things. The post-play discussion. You want it to be different.
Right. The idea is not to do, look, I mean, nobody likes talk. I don't like talkbacks. Right?
I hate them.
Yeah,
I just
they're terrible.
Hate them.
Right. So the idea is to take that impulse that there ought to be a way that we can talk about this experience we just shared that is not that. And the way to do it is to turn it upside down. Mm-hmm. Instead of saying, now you out there get to sort of lob, you know, softballs or take pot shots at the people on stage, I, sitting on stage, I'm going to ask you the questions. And we together are going to figure out what this play just said and what it means to our lives and to our society today.
So it's kind of a collaborative conversation between the people who have been in the play or written the play. No, it's you.
It's me. I mean, I don't want to put some playwright on the spot and say, now this playwright's going to defend his choices. The idea is to do it, treat it exactly like a town hall meeting, except instead of talking about a law, we're talking about a play.
Wow. The first one, you have selected a play, not the most noted play by one of my favorite playwrights. Right. You've selected a very unusual play,
yeah.
I think.
Well, I wish it were more usual, because I think it's like a great American play that we don't do much because it's a one act and we don't take one act seriously. This is a play by Thornton Wilder, the author of Our Town, and the play that became Hello, Dolly, which is now Knockin' 'Em Dead on Broadway. Wilder's one-act play that he wrote when he was here at the University of Chicago is called The Long Christmas Dinner. And it's a story about an American family having a Christmas meal that, as it happens, you watch them for 40 minutes, and in those 40 minutes, 90 years fly by. You may recognize that from Citizen Kane, because Orson Welles stole the idea, acknowledged that he had stolen the idea from Thornton Wilder. It's important to me. The reason why I rushed to get the company started when I did is because I love this play.
Yeah.
It's been a hard year in a lot of ways, personally, as a country. And I thought, before this year is out, let's have one night when a bunch of Chicagoans can sit in a room at the Harold Washington Library, which is the building that belongs to all of us, and listen to the best actors in Chicago read this play.
How did you recruit the actors? I mean, how did you make a call out? You've got a great director working on the show, and you've got some very, very notable actors. How did you do that?
Yeah, the director is Henry Wishkamper. He's at the Goodman. He has directed the Christmas Carol there for the last couple of years. An incredible talent. Some of these people were friends of mine, like Miguel Cervantes, who's playing Alexander Hamilton right now in the Chicago company of Hamilton. You know, some of them I'd known a little. Another, you know, radio voice, Peter Sagal from Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is going to be involved. And then, you know, I've lived here for a couple of years and I had this list in my head of the people who I thought had done incredible work and wanted to work with. And it's important that, you know, Thornton Wilder said this, that he wrote this play about one family, but it's really about all families. Mm. It's about time. It's about love. It's about what endures when people are gone. And so we cast it to reflect Chicago. We want this cast to look like what Chicago looks like,
yeah.
Which brings us to the
reason you're on the show.
That's right.
You people are now going to have the opportunity, if not to participate, at least to be part of this first venture by Make Believe Association.
Right.
Jeremy wants your photos.
That's right. So we are taking what Thornton Wilder said as a directive. This is a play about all families. We are doing it with a cast that reflects Chicago. We're doing it in what feels like the city's town hall, the Harold Washington Library. We are doing it for free. But I want to go one step further and say that this story about one family looks like our families. So what I'm asking Chicagoans to do is share a photo of your family. It doesn't have to be at Christmas time. It's nice if it's now, if it's 2017, but it doesn't have to be. But what I'm asking you to do, send us that photo, and we're going to have a slideshow that we're going to project on stage before the reading starts so that Chicagoans will have a chance to see this is what our city looks like. This is who we are. And this story that we're about to hear has something to say to all of us. We've set up an email account where you can email something to us. There are two ways, I guess. One is the email. And I'll say this a couple times. If you have on your phone right now a photo of your family that you like and you want it to be part of this slideshow, email it to family@mbelieve.org. That's family@mbelieve.org. family@mbelieve.org. You can do that right now if you want to. The other way is if you go to Facebook, if you look for my name, you'll see that there's a post up there now where we've shared one that we got from the Chicago History Museum. This beautiful, evocative photo of these two sisters.
Of those two sisters?
Yep.
It's one of the great pictures I've ever seen. It looks like it could have been taken yesterday.
Well, that's sort of the point of the play, right?
Yeah, exactly.
It's a photo of these two sisters in Chicago with their Christmas wreath from 1917. It's exactly 100 years old. Well, we want 2017 photos that are in that tradition. Anyway, you can share the photo with us there, put it in the comments, put it in the thread, and then the city will get to see it that night.
Are you rehearsing the play?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Henry, the director, and the cast will be working on it. And, you know, it's not, you know, we don't have costumes. We don't have a set. Wilder's play doesn't really need it. It's going to be a reading at music stands because we want people to use their imaginations.
Yeah.
You know, we want people to have to kind of finish the play for themselves in their minds. But, you know, all the more reason to get these family photos sent in, family@mbelieve.org, so that there's that real thing, that real sign of actual Chicago families.
Are you? I know you toyed with being an actor when you were a young man.
I never toyed
yes,
with being
you
an actor.
Did.
No.
You did.
No.
Yes, you did.
Although this does remind me, I'm you know, thinking about this production company now. I'm listening to you read these things with the greatest voice in Chicago. I'm thinking, what was it? Was it Curly in Oklahoma? Huh? Was it Man of La Mancha?
That's right.
What's the Rick Kogan? What's the Rick Kogan theatrical CD
when
look like?
Are you nervous? Is what I'm saying. Are you anxious at all about Monday?
No.
Why not?
No. You know, for one thing, these days, there are enough other things to be worried about.
Yeah, good point.
Look at the ingredients we've got here.
We have
one of the most beautiful plays ever written.
A great space.
We have a beautiful theater, thanks to Brian Bannon and the Chicago Public Library. They're letting us use that space. We have the most astonishing cast of Chicago actors. Cheryl Lynn Bruce, Shannon Cochran. I mean, these actors, if you've seen a play in Chicago, you've seen these actors before.
And Shannon Cochran and I once shared a stage at the Goodman Theater in Pal Joey.
There you go. See, Pal Joey.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have gotten there in the first six guesses, but I was going to get there. But we've got the play. We've got the actors.
Yeah.
You know, the response has been great. I hope people are listening to this. If you're interested, come out. Admission is free, and it's on a first-come, first-served basis that night. So
you have also, to move forward, you've also commissioned a work by my old pal, Nate Marshall.
Yeah.
He's a very, very talented writer and poet. Yep. How do you find Nate And what did you tell him?
I was a fan. A play? Yeah. No, I was a fan. I mean, I knew Nate Marshall's writing. He's involved with Young Chicago Authors.
Yes, he is.
I was giving a speech at a school, and I saw his name was on the list after mine to talk. And I asked, is that the same Nate Marshall? So we met. We got to be friends. And, you know, part of the reason to start Make Believe is to give chances to people who aren't writing plays yet. And he was just the first guy. It just felt obvious to me that, of course,
and
Nate Marshall.
No kidding. Yeah. No kidding. That's a great, great choice.
So come on Monday night and you can meet him. He'll be in the audience.
Well, and send your family photos. That's one of the reasons I'm excited to see this play. And I'm excited to be at the liftoff of the Make Believe Association. But I want to see your pictures, too. So send a family. How can you resist doing this? How can you not want to send your family picture? Whether it's you and your kids or you and your grandparents, who cares?
Yeah. Haven't you always wanted to see your family on stage? I'm giving you that chance.
Here it is.
Literally.
Here's your opportunity.
They'll
you don't
be
have
projected.
To pay. This is not like, oh, I bought this at an auction and I got to be in this play. It's
right.
The real thing. Family at MBELIEVE.org. I'll put this on my Facebook page because I want, or you send it to me and I'll pass them on to Jeremy. R. Kogan. At ChicagoTribune.com. I'll pass them along to him. And I let's take a little break. I may or may not. I'm going to keep you here, Jeremy.
Okay.
I was going to read another Royko thing, but I'll do that some other time. I want to talk more about this. So is that okay?
Great.
Jasmine, is that okay? Jasmine Cooper and Krista Flores are running this show. Okay, let's do it. Great. A few more minutes with Jeremy McCarter of book fame and... now, soon to be of Make-Believe Association fame, Make-Believe Association launches Monday at 7 o'clock at the Harold Washington Library, the Cindy Pritzker Auditorium. It's beautiful if you've never been there. It's a play, a Thornton Wilder play called The Long Christmas Dinner with some of Chicago's best actors and a great director in Henry Wishkamp. The notion of the Make-Believe Association is to eventually have people talk to you, have you grill the audience after a performance of a show or a reading, or it won't always be a play. It may
right.
be a concert or something. Not this time.
Not this time, no. I should have mentioned this earlier maybe, that the model, what we exist to do is to try to create this bridge where here's a great story. You know, these stories, we're in a very divided time. I think stories are one of the forces that can pull us together.
No question.
If we give ourselves a chance to talk about
them. The arts in general. Yeah,
that's right. This one, The Long Christmas Dinner on Monday night, 7 o'clock, is going to be a little different. You know, I wanted to do this play because it's a beautiful play. It's about something that every person there can share, which is the experience of being in a family, of feeling time pass, of watching one generation replace the next generation. The reason to do that play is because it's been a hard year, and let's end on something that's beautiful. So we're not going to do the talking after this one. My hope is that you know, people will send their family photos, they will watch this play, watch this reading of this play together, and then go home and hug your family. We'll have plenty of time to talk in 2018. For now, you know, let's try to end this one with on a grace note.
Boy, is that a great idea! And you can be part of this by sending a photograph to family. At MBelieve, that's MBELIEVE.org. And that photo, unless it is some kind of incredibly grotesque thing, or you're all wearing, you know, a stormtrooper uniforms or something, will be projected on the stage before the show.
And this, I assume this goes without saying, but, you know, we know what people who aren't in Chicago say about Chicago. We know the ways that people talk about this city. And this is subtly a way to say this is Chicago at its best. This is when we love our relatives, you know. And I should say, I just got an email from someone I work with on the design of Make Believe Association who said that thanks to you, Rick, and to the listeners of the show, that I guess the photos are rolling in, which
That's
is wonderful.
Fantastic. I mean, whether you can go to the show or not, I think there is something this is, and I hope you call it at the Make Believe site, and you can go to mbelieve.org to really explore the site, that something around Christmas can become a sort of Christmas, at least holiday, kind of tradition, whether it's another, you know, the play written by somebody teaching at the University of Chicago, we'll see about that, or something else. And I think some of what you might do can indeed, with make-believe, be sort of timed to various events.
For sure.
In the city, don't you think?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, look, you know, my background was in newspapers and magazines.
Yeah, I know.
So it's the way I'm now wired to think about how a story lands at a certain moment. You know, it used to be in a news cycle. I don't have to think about the news cycle in quite the same way, but I always
certainly
think about,
not. Yeah.
You know, this whole, the programming, this play, the long Christmas dinner, programming it with family photos involved is entirely a response to saying, look at where this country is right now.
Mm-hmm.
Look at the way people talk about Chicago. Like, what would feel right at this time?
The whole notion of leaving the Cindy Pritzker Auditorium in the Harold Washington Library, and if they're not with you, going and finding your family and hugging your family is just a lovely, or you can, you know, leave the theater and go walk down State Street and look in the windows of what I still call Marshall Fields and then go home and hug your family. I think that's a really, really good thought.
Yeah, you could even bring your family if you want.
Sure.
Admission is free, and you know, seats are going to be available on a first come, first serve basis. It's at 7 o'clock, so get there early if you want to be sure.
Yeah.
And if you're sending us a photo, then you know, it'll be on that screen.
Yeah, send the photos. I cannot wait to see these photos. I mean, that's going to be one of the highlights. It's certainly one of the highlights of the show.
And I should say that my board will be very angry with me if I do not mention this too. If you can't make it on Monday night and you don't have a family photo to send in, you could make a contribution, because Make Believe Association is a nonprofit production company. We're never going to take a dollar in admission for anything that we do. So it exists based on the generosity and the support of Chicagoans. So you can do that at mbelieve.org.
Is your board listed at that site? Your board members?
I don't think it is.
I don't think it is.
We're moving
either.
Fast, Rick.
Tell me over a drink sometime. Jeremy, one of the things I look forward to in 2018 is, there are many things I wish for, but one thing that I think I might be able to pull off is to have drinks with Jeremy McCarter at the Billy Goat, and which will, again, then he'll, next time he's on the air here, he'll go, Rick, our next Make Believe Association show is like live at the Billy Goat. Don't let that happen, Jeremy.
I like you doing my voice better than I like me doing my voice. What are you doing Monday night?
Don't let that happen. I will be there Monday night.
The role of Jeremy McCarter will be played by Rick Hogan at this performance.
You can. I'll say, what do you want to know? I'm going to tell you what to think of this play. Again, you can. It's free. It's at 7 o'clock Monday at the Harold Washington Library. You can also be part of it if you, for some reason, cannot make it by sending your family photos to family@mbelieve.org. Jeremy, it's always great to see you. Love to the family.
Great to
see you Monday, too.
Sounds great.
See you Monday. We'll take a break, and then I'll prepare to go upstairs and let those of you who listen to the stream listen to Joe Siegel, the one and only Joe Siegel.